Maybe I'm where Zach is. I just need a minute to finish thinking about stuff that we were singing. That's good. I was thinking how we enjoy the blessings of God. Think about this week. I've been training some leaders from Nebraska. Now, they're a little different than Hong Kong and a little different than central Wisconsin because I have a rancher and a seed salesman and kind of a different circle of guys in the Nebraska group. And so every week they're talking about the crops and how God's providing the rain and enabling them to get on a field or get off a field. And they have their Thanksgiving on this everyday life stuff, kind of like us. We just have different everyday life stuff, right? So like yesterday, I was eating strawberries out of my garden. You know what I mean? That's like, thank you, right? I mean, that's just awesome when summer hits and you start to have fruit from your labors. And we have thank you. And many times we're really good with God in that everyday mundane stuff, especially if it's working out okay, right? Then we can trust God. But then you're like Daniel, and you're going to want to find your way to the book of Daniel. But Daniel, the everyday life stuff, it got turned on its head, didn't it? I mean, we started in chapter 1, and his faith structure got unraveled. You know, temple's going to be gone. He's not around any of the people that love God. He's in a totally new world of Babylon with the Chaldeans and pagan thinking completely. And so everything of the everyday life turned on its head. Some Christians, though, we have pretty good faith when the everyday circumstances, maybe they don't even look very good, but we know how to trust God in that. But then we look at our world around us, the big picture of the world, and we go, what is going on? And we live like totally upset, turned upside down, fretting people, which doesn't give a very good picture to the world of what a Christian is. Today's passage, we've come out of the everyday mundane being turned on its head. Now you're going to see a passage where God shows that he has absolute control and he is unfolding the big picture of the world. Therefore, you can trust in him. It may not be comfortable. It may look awful for your lifetime and beyond. In Daniel's case, that was kind of true. There were little highlight moments, but he knew, whew, this is tough. Matter of fact, what God revealed was so troubling that even the supreme king of the land couldn't sleep. It rocked his world, and he began to distrust and look at all the people around him like, I think they're out to get me. We're in Daniel 2, so you want to find your way there. I'm actually going to read the chapter as we walk through it today because it says it, the story. I think it says it well and kind of just maybe point some things out so we get the point of why Daniel was writing. And I come to that. Why did Daniel write Daniel? Obviously, God told him to. But who was he writing to? Well, he was writing to Jewish people because several of the chapters are in Hebrew. But a bunch of the chapters of Daniel, unlike other books in the Bible primarily, is in the language of the day. It's in Aramaic. And so he is writing to the Chaldean, to the Babylonian, to the Medo-Persian guy, to down the road, the Greeks that would know that and be able to look at it and say, what's going on? And he was reaching to them. You might even say in some ways that he's writing exactly to us because the events or what he unfolds are the stuff that's happening around us, his control, his direction, and we can look at it with great confidence. I love it when God reaches beyond his little chosen niche and shows us how actually he's working to the whole world. And he always is, just he doesn't always open it up to us. Daniel certainly shows that, and I think it helps us relate and jump right into it. So as we said, Daniel, he's at the spot of losing everything, but in his great trust of God, he absolutely is resolved to do right. And this comes to bear in eating the right things and of holding God's truth and taking a stand with great wisdom and craftiness. And you're going to see Daniel's wisdom and craftiness and how he speaks in this chapter as well. And out of that, what happens? Well, in Daniel 1, 9 and 17, it says, and God gave. And in Daniel 1, 17, it says, and God gave. What did he give? He gave them learning and wisdom and understanding. He gave them favor with the person over them so they could function. And God then, because it's part of his plan, as it said in verses 20 and 21 of chapter 1, he put them in front of the king because this was his plan. God's plan for believers is to be in the world where he put them and to be used by God right where he places you. So don't go run and hide and wall yourself off with three other Christians and don't look out. No, he said, I've put you right there where I'm in control, God says, and where I have a plan, and I will give favor where you need it. He's going to do that. And you see it in how some of this passage even connects to the New Testament today. So we're in this passage in chapter 2 where really we see two worlds that are going to collide. And it's very definitive. I would say the first part of the chapter shows the world where they have other gods. They don't believe in a one true God, the God of heaven and earth, who made it and who rules and who gives forgiveness and who sent his son to die on the cross. We have this world that has all kinds of gods, whether they name their gods or just worship themselves in their own direction. It is the world apart from the one true God. And then there's the world that follows him. This never changes. And Daniel kind of brings this to light in how he unfolds the chapter. And so let's look first in these first 13 verses or so about the world with gods, the one that has all kinds of things they're chasing after, trying to figure out how to live life. Look at verse 1. It says, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. There's a lot going on, and Daniel cryptically writes it. But the first thing is, you see that in this world with gods, what you end up with always is troubled spirit. Because you really don't have definitive answer. When I interact with people today, and I get to know them well enough to challenge their truth basis, and you ask some questions, they may become defiant. And generally, my friends don't, but they're gonna struggle, and they come to a spot where they realize, okay, I don't know for sure, but this is where I've landed. And I think, ooh, that is troubling of spirit. When we as believers walk away from who God is and how he defines and lays out the world, we end up with the same troubled spirit inside, don't we? Some of you are looking at the elections in America and you're like, oh, you know, and you lose sleep. And the scripture would tell us this is all kind of unfolding quite normally. Well, why are we without sleep, right? The world with gods has troubled spirit. Nebuchadnezzar has that because he sees this dream. And, you know, if you read carefully, he didn't forget the dream. That's not why he was asking them to give the dream to him. He was asking them because it says in the next paragraph, he didn't trust them. So he knew the dream, and he knew the dream wasn't good. How do you know that? Because he couldn't sleep. Okay? He didn't know exactly what it meant, but he knew that didn't look good. Okay? And he could pick that up from the dream. And as a supreme ruler, one of the number one things he's looking for is the person that's about to stab him in the back. I mean, that's what you do as king. Sounds like a great existence, doesn't it? But he's king, and there's treachery always around him, and he has this dream, and in their culture, dreams were hugely significant. It's a troubling dream. It looks like a defeat-like dream, so therefore, this is a warning to me that there is trouble around me. So he calls in magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and Chaldeans. It's very interesting. The Chaldeans are the ones that answer him because they are the same nationality as him. See, he had all these groups of people, magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, some of whom were Chaldeans, and many were from other nations. It's very interesting, too, how Daniel lists this. He does not put himself in this list. You're going to see later in the chapter, he's in a group called the wise men, which includes all these people, but he never puts himself as sorcerer, enchanter, and astrologer or magician. The reason he doesn't is because he doesn't believe that stuff. Okay, these are the people, you know, that sacrifice a goat, cut the liver in half, and tell the king what his dream is. Okay, I mean, that's kind of how they work. Okay, very demonic stuff. And Daniel studied all of it, even learned how to do all of it, because it's part of his education, but he didn't believe any of it. Okay, and so he never labels himself exactly this way. And he knows that's that world, and I'm part of a different world. And he keeps that straight in his mind, even though he's interacting with them and even protects them in this chapter out of kindness. So they're summoned to the king, and the Chaldeans, you know, they're trying to protect everybody, say, oh, king, live forever. And I'll tell you what, they go from a troubled spirit to a very troubled situation. Look at verse 5. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, pretty obvious, show me the dream and its interpretation. And they answered a second time. You kind of see them on stage, you know, in front of the king, like, well, you know, king, if you just tell us the dream, we'll show its interpretation. You're like, that is the dumbest response you could have ever had in that situation, isn't it? I mean, he's already told you, you know I'm firm. You know, you can see they're just backpedaling because they give this lame statement that they've already said once. And he's looking at them like, it's a ridiculous bunch of people in front of me. They're in deep trouble. I mean, they're going to be torn. They're going to be hooked up to two horses. And they're going to smack the rear ends of those horses and let them run. That does not sound like a pleasant way to go. Torn limb from limb. And he's looking at all of them. Because remember, he thinks someone's going to kill me. And so I'll get rid of all of them. I'll start fresh. Verse 8, you have the demands and the lies. The king answered and says, I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time. Because you gave a stupid answer, right? Because you see that the word for me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there's but one sentence for you. You've agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change. That's him saying, you're planning to lie to me till I'm gone. So he's making this very personal, like, you're going to get rid of me. I know what's going on. And it's because this dream's in his head. He says, therefore, tell me the dream, and I'll know that you can show me its interpretation. So he just lays it down. This is the way it's going to be. And you see their powerlessness. When you're part of that kingdom of gods, you are powerless. Look at the powerlessness. Verse 10, the Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. For no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. He says, we're the supreme. Nobody ever asks this. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. The king has them in a corner now because they have said for years, I cut the liver in half, and I can read from the gods that this is what you're supposed to do. They've been saying they're representing the gods for years. And now, when their life is on the line, they admit, we don't really know where our truth is coming from. Only something absolutely supreme could tell what another man thinks on his bed. And you love how Daniel writes this because he's just setting it up, isn't he? He's creating the intensity that, oh my goodness, there's only one answer. And Nebuchadnezzar has being set up in his mind to recognize it would take something other than human to get this answered. It's at this point that we find ourselves many times. You see, here's this kingdom, this world with gods, you know, false gods. But the thing is, that kingdom in the world never remains separate from the kingdom that follows God. The two collide, don't they? And they collide right here in verse 12. Because of this thing, the king was angry and very furious, and he commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. Now he opened up the category, and he is going to eliminate the entire group, not just sorcerers and astrologers, magicians, but he says even the broadest sense, the wise men, everybody's destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. And you can see the two worlds colliding. Here you have this unstable, fretting king who has gods that his people can't even get truth from because they're not real. And you have the kingdom, those who would follow Christ, which is Daniel and his three dudes in Babylon. That's it. And they're on the line because they're going to be killed. Let me tell you, God is faithful when the worlds collide in Daniel's day, and he's faithful today. He has not changed. Look at how he helps them. I mean, that's why Daniel writes it. Because this collide of kingdoms or of worlds, worldviews, as Pastor Jack started the service, this collision happens all the time throughout history. Wherever there are Christians and wherever there are those who aren't, there's going to be a collision of view, a collision of trust, and there's going to be unrealistic things that get laid upon them. In this case, Daniel hadn't even had a chance to answer. Look at what God does now as we look at the other world, the world of the God of heaven, those who trust him. Look at what he does there. Look at verse 14. It says, "Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard." And he knows this guy, but Arioch's following the commands. He doesn't have a choice. He comes to collect Daniel and his three friends because he's gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. So what is he doing? He's gathering together because a king, if he thinks there's a threat against his life, he doesn't kill these people in secret and stuff them away. He makes an ostentatious display of his power and of all those who would cross it. So he is basically going to line up chariot horse after chariot horse with all the wise men and Chaldeans and a great spectacle and tear them all in pieces. Don't you want to go to that event? But you would go because it's better than being tied to the horse, right? And so this is what the king is arranging. So Arioch, he's just going around gathering all these people, and and he declares to Arioch, verse 15, the king's captain, "Why is the decree of the king so urgent?" So Daniel hasn't been in court. He doesn't know exactly how this went down, and Arioch made the matter known to Daniel. Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. You have to follow the story carefully. Daniel's writing very, briefly. But basically what's happened is Daniel wasn't there for that event. We don't know why. He doesn't tell us. The wise men just weren't called in is what it seems like. And so now he hears about it, and the urgency is like, don't we get time to, figure it out? And so he goes to the king, and he requests time. You say, why would he give Daniel time when he was complaining about the other people stalling? Because there's a difference between stalling when you have no way to get the answer. Well, that's what they were doing. They didn't say, give us some time, we'll figure it out. They didn't say that, did they? They just knew, we're toast, or torn in this case. What can we do? But Daniel, he's like, whoa, can we have some time to go sort this? Matter of fact, you appoint the day and I'll come back. And so Daniel goes, and he meets with great, I called it partnership in prayer. This hasn't changed in God's kingdom. God's people partner, and I'm preaching to the choir because here you are in church partnering. We work together in the world where we live, and we need to. If you've tried to do your Christian life by itself, you just realize something's wrong, something's off, and we get there, right? We get tired of church, we get tired of the troubles. It doesn't go well, and we're just like, phooey on it. I worship God over in a corner. And you can worship God over in a corner, but you cannot be what he really intends, because he intends that one another together. And we need it for strength, too. Daniel goes back in verse 17. Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. For those of you who know Rakshak and Benny, that's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Okay, kind of put all that together. And you want to follow in this book, because he always labels, when it's Daniel and his dudes, he always labels them by their Hebrew names. When they are in their little world working on something like now, he names them by the names that God gave them, that have God in them, the one true God of heaven and earth. And then when he's in front of the king, he calls them by their Babylonian names. It's kind of cool in the book. And Daniel goes to his house, and it's like his way of saying to the Hebrew person who would be reading this in Aramaic, like, we were followers of God in this distant land. That's what he's saying by using their names. And he told them, he said, pray and seek mercy from the God of heaven. The Chaldeans had said, there's nobody except the gods in the heavens. Daniel says, so let's go to the God of heaven. You can see the Babylonian reading this, like, oh, they went to the God of heaven? The God of heaven, like one God of heaven, not just gods like Chaldeans. I wonder if this one God of heaven could be one God, and how would I know that? You could see how the Babylonian or the Medo-Persian who's reading Daniel is going to be thinking through quite a few things about his world. And he says, go ask mercy of this God of heaven concerning this mystery so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed and the rest of the wise men of Babylon. What does God do? Well, he gives mercy. That's who our God is. In verse 19, it says, then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, and really, you should go home and spend all week on this prayer if you're going to pick one little section, because it's beautiful. It starts with Daniel painting the picture of who God is in kind of almost an impersonal, distant way. He just talks about God. He says, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He's describing this God. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. Kind of tells you what the dream's going to be about, right? He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. No darkness with him. Sounds like James. Daniel paints this grandiose picture of God, but his view of God is not distant. It's just grounded. He gives this truth, and then, look at, he goes to second person. He starts saying, you. He starts to worship God very personally. As he interacts with him, he says, to you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise. For you have given me wisdom and might and have now made known to me what we ask of you. For you have made known to us the king's matter. This is the young man. Right now, he's probably like 18 years old. Based on kind of putting the dates together that are in the text. He's like 18 years old. And he's worshiping the God of his fathers in a distant land where he's basically a slave. Educated, kind of a decent setting, but slave nonetheless. And he's about to be torn limb from limb. Just kind of your average day. God gives him the dream. And he doesn't even know if Nebuchadnezzar is going to receive this, right? Oh, he does, doesn't he? You just see this in Daniel. It's like, he, matter of fact, his trust is so clean, you almost don't notice it. You know, he writes it, and you're like, oh yeah, yep, yep, that's the way I would do it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, really? Really? You'd be like this? I mean, Daniel never had a dream revealed. That he had to go before the supreme king of the whole continent. And he just worships God. Thanks and praise to God when he is a eunuch in the house of the king. I mean, just keep putting him where he is. And you just see incredible trust on the part of Daniel. So therefore, Daniel goes to Arioch. Remember, the king's guard is ready to kill him because he's been led off to his little place with his friends to think and pray. And it says, who the king appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I'll show the king the interpretation. So he sets up that date, walks in, and it's just so interesting to me how God reveals himself in this wisdom. He reveals himself so powerfully that lost pagan king has to submit to it. I didn't say believe in entirety, but he submitted to it. God reveals himself. Look at this. He first reveals himself to Arioch. Verse 25, then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and thus said to him, I have found among the exiles from Judah a man who will make known to the king the interpretation. Nebuchadnezzar's tearing people in half. I am not siding with anybody if I'm Arioch. I'm like, there's this dude, says he knows something. You talked to him earlier, that's why I'm bringing him back, right? I mean, I would distance myself. Arioch believed Daniel. And they had been in court together. He had seen him. And when Daniel came, I don't know if he gave the dream ahead of time to him and the interpretation. I don't know what took place. But Arioch sides with him. This is incredibly dangerous in the court. And it tells you when God reveals himself, people follow, don't they? Arioch comes in and he's like, yep, I'm standing with Daniel and it's going to look good on my resume. I know what's going to happen here. I mean, he talk about trust. So he introduces him that way, and the king declares to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, now he's being Babylonian, are you able to make known to me the dream that I've seen and its interpretation? Verse 27 says, Daniel answered the king and said, no wise man enchanter, magician, or astrologer can show to the king the mystery that the king has asked. This is clever. He's setting him up so that he has to look at God. Clever part number one. Clever part number two, he does not disagree with his cohorts that are magicians and astrologers, does he? Because he's leaving room for the king to remove them or keep them. Because if he attacks them and the king decides to have them stay, what position is Daniel going to be in? He's going to be in trouble. He's going to have hardship. So he just that's not why the text is here, to learn wisdom per se. But if you watch how Daniel has wisdom and walks through this, it is like a blueprint for how to handle work. And I doubt your boss is as bad as Nebuchadnezzar, right? He hasn't brought two tow motors in yet, has he, with ropes? He thought about it, but he didn't do it yet, okay? Don't tell him. He gets some ideas, you know. But, this is just a blueprint for this kind of wisdom. So he just says, King, no wise man. Your astrologers were right. No man can give this answer. Verse 28, but there is a God in heaven, who reveals mysteries. And he's made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Whoa, wisdom statement, right? He doesn't go, and he showed me, King, so that he could straighten you out. That's how we present stuff like this. He doesn't. He says, King, you've been so very honored to be given this dream. And he treats the king, who's ready to kill him, with great honor. He says, God has revealed to you what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head as you lay on the bed are these. To you, O king, as you lay in your bed, came thoughts of what would be after this, and he who reveals mysteries made known to you what is to be. The king didn't tell anybody where he had seen these mysteries, where he'd had these visions. He could have been standing on top of the rooftop. Could have been out in the field. So one of the things that Daniel does right out of the gate to put the king at ease is, you were on your bed, and this is where it came to you. And he sets the context, showing the king that he knows exactly what took place. But as for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because of any wisdom that I have more than all the living, but in order that the interpretation may be known to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your mind. He says, this has been revealed to me because God is honoring you to give you actually the interpretation. So he honors Nebuchadnezzar twice in how he speaks this. Then he reveals the dream. Verse 31, you saw, O king, and behold, a great image. This image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of this image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. As you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand. It's interesting that he uses the word hand there. I was kind of wondering if that's the same hand that writes on the wall later in Daniel. It's no human hand, and we know it's not human hand, right? But anyway, something, that must be a hand, but non-human hand, cuts it out, this stone, and it strikes the image on its feet of iron and clay, broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold, all together were broken in pieces and became like Psalm 1. Became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away. To the Hebrew, they would hear this and go, the wicked are done. Right? Because who's chaff and who's carried away? The wicked. The Aramaic-speaking person wouldn't know that. So it's kind of like Daniel weaving something in for his Hebrew brothers so they it could kind of go right by the other readers of this or the hearers of this. They became like chaff. They were the wicked. The wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. Who's the we? Was that God and Daniel? Maybe. I think it's Daniel with his three buddies standing behind him. Again, wisdom. Because right at the end of the chapter, he asks for something for these three. And I think he made a show of the four of them because he didn't know if when the king heard this, he'd kill everybody except Daniel. That was a distinct possibility. You have no idea, right? God didn't give that vision to him. So he placed close to him the we. The four of them, so that the king would see visually, they're with me. And of course, then he refers to them at the end of the chapter, and they're given a place of standing. So he gives the dream. That's the first step. The next step is the interpretation. And the reason he gives the interpretation again is so God reveals himself. And I like this interpretation because, people that don't, they want to discredit Daniel. There's a whole group of people that would say Daniel was written way late. It wasn't written by Daniel in Babylon. It was written way later in the Maccabean period of history. And those of you who are history buffs, you can go back and read and sort the date of that. And if you did that, you would have all the way to Rome pretty well covered, almost to Rome. I mean, it's pretty well covered. So this could just be Daniel writing history if you didn't believe Daniel was written in Babylon. And so you think, oh man, was Daniel written in Babylon? How do we know this? Well, just hold on. Because we're going to get to some prophecy in Daniel. A very exact prophecy of when Christ is going to show up. That no one argues had it been written. If you're going to choose that Maccabean period, it was written then. And it's such solid prophecy that comes true that the whole book becomes true. I mean, it's stunning what Daniel writes down in later chapters. So I'm just going to tell you this. Daniel wrote this when he was in Babylon. Okay, just know that. He was a real person who really did this, and he laid this out. Now, he didn't lay out beyond Babylon. He didn't lay out the kingdoms in this chapter. I mean, you can read the interpretation. It says, "You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the might, and the glory." So he accentuates that you have this kingdom, power, might, and glory, but it did come from God, didn't it? "And into whose hand he's given wherever they dwell, the children of men, the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, making you rule over all them. You are the head of gold." Nebuchadnezzar's kind of like, yeah, I knew that. What I'm worried about is the silver, right? I mean, he hears this as it's given. And then Daniel, he just very cryptically says, "Another kingdom inferior to you shall arise after you, and a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And there'll be a fourth kingdom strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, it'll break and crush all these." So there's no remnant of the first three kingdoms that isn't ruled by the fourth kingdom. It says, "And as you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom. But some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with soft clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. As you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage. But they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay." What does that mean? Who is that? I gave it a really bland description. Coalition in the end days. It hasn't happened yet. I think it is happening. I think, look at where Greece was, where the Roman kingdom was, the Persian kingdom. And you see all these people groups mingling together. And kind of unique, and I never knew this when I got the flannel graph version of this story, okay? But he talks about marriage. What does that mean? You know, it's people groups agreeing. It may be more about system. Could it be Muslim and Christian marrying? Pieces that are strong and pieces that are not. Could it be, I think, Western world and Eastern world colliding and having unity at some point? It's going to, isn't it? And Rome can represent that whole Western world. And think about Europe. Isn't Europe right now just an absolute convergence of Western and Eastern thought? And it's not yet formed into a kingdom. And it's more than just Europe, right? That because of that unifying of two ways of thinking, it could easily be a coalition across the globe. And I think later pieces in Daniel point very specifically at that. The point that it's in this book is that God Almighty, the God of heaven, knows what's coming. As surely as he knows whether we'll have wheat harvest, and we thank him when it happens in the short term, he knows the end of the kingdoms. Because the last piece, this final forever kingdom, it hasn't happened yet. "And the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed." nor shall that kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. So it wipes out the vestiges of any of those kingdoms, any of their thinkings, and makes one final kingdom that is forever. Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces iron, bronze, clay, silver, and gold, a great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. Then something happened that never happens. A Jewish 18 or 19-year-old is standing there, and King Nebuchadnezzar falls on his face and pays homage to Daniel. Can you imagine the Jewish boy who's reading this for the first time, who's resettling in the land, and he's like, yeah, yes. The God of heaven's revealed, and the king of the known world kisses dirt in front of him. Yeah. And to the Chaldean, he what? Our supreme ruler bowed his knee? Supreme rulers, at best you kiss their hand while you're on your knees, right? They don't bow down to anyone. He fell on his face, paid homage to Daniel, commanded that an offering and incense be offered up to him. The king answered and said to Daniel, it's interesting, the king did not worship Daniel in this statement. He says, truly your God is God of gods and sovereign or Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you've been able to reveal this mystery. He says, your God is it. Well, that doesn't mean that Nebuchadnezzar was going to follow that one true God. But he was forced at that moment. Why? Because his own words had said it. If you can give me the dream, then I know the interpretation is real. He set it up and God said, fine, I'll give you the dream. And then you'll have to believe the interpretation. And he did. The king gave Daniel high honors and many great gifts, made him rule over the whole province of Babylon, chief prefect over all the wise men. And Daniel made a request to the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel remained in the king's court. Clash of kingdoms. And God comes out as the revealer and the one who's worshipped. This sermon is not one of those things where you go home and do four things. But you might go home and do one thing that changes everything if you listen close. There is one God who knows all, who controls all, and who personally rules over all. And he intends to do that with you as an individual right here, right now. And he is doing that and will do that across the globe. There is no surprise to God. There's no need for Christian to fret, right? Matter of fact, he's laid it out. We know how the world will unfold, don't we? We know how nations crumble. We don't know every specific yet. He hasn't given that. But we know that stuff. So why fret? Let's be the believer like Daniel was. See, as Christians, when we don't fret, when we walk knowing God is in control, in my life where I can lose everything like Daniel, and in the big picture of world history, when we know both of those things, that he's in control, and we live in his world, even when the other world collides with us, we live there in trust. Let me tell you, he is revealed. The people around us know who he is. And that's how we take the peace of God to them, that they might bow the knee and believe. Lord, I pray that we just be people who simply go home and let this truth give us courage, give us clarity. And may we be people who speak of it and its many nuances and the great wisdom that's contained here to help one another live godly as people part of your kingdom as it collides with the kingdom of the earth. Lord, your kingdom is forever. May we live for that and in that. In Jesus' name, amen.